Well, hello, and thank you for joining us for another edition of Notable Notes, the monthly podcast brought to you by Document Records in association with American Sound Archives. I'm your host, Larry Tedder. Thank you once again for listening. This month we have a special presentation for you on the life and the career of Miss Ada Jones, First Lady of the Phonograph. This is by noted researcher Milford Fargo, who spent over 20 years researching the recordings, music, life, and legend of Ada Jones. Our program this month is a very special one. It was originally presented by Milford Fargo as a slideshow presentation at the Association for Recorded Sound Collectors Convention held in West Orange, New Jersey. Milford Fargo had dedicated much of his life to the research of the recordings and life of Ada Jones and prepared this presentation. We would like to dedicate this show to the life and research of Milford Fargo, as well as Ada Jones, from March 1977. This is Ada Jones, First Lady of the Phonograph.
Jim O'Shea was cast away upon an Indian isle. The natives there, they like his hair, they like his Irish smile. So made him chief and gendarum, the nabob of them all. They called him Gigible Jay and raked him out so gay. So he rode to Dublin Bay to his sweetheart just to say, sure I've got rings on my fingers, bells on my toes, elephants to ride upon my little Irish rose. So come to your nabob and next Patrick say, be Mistress Mumbo Jumbo Gigible Jay. O'Shea. O'er the sea went Rose McGee to see her neighbor grand. He sat within his palanquin, and when she kissed his hand, he led her to his harem, where he had wives galore. She started shedding a tear, said he now had no fear. I'm keeping these wives here, just for ornaments, my dear. Sure, I've got rings on my fingers, bells on my toes, elephants to ride upon my little Irish rose. So come to your nabob, the next Patrick say, be Mistress Mumbo Jumbo Gigible Jay O'Shea.
I'm often asked, why on earth did you get interested in Ada Jones? Matter of fact, I got a letter from an irate man in Buffalo when Walter Winchell put in his syndicated column that I was looking for information on Ada, and anybody had known her, let me know. And the man said, why in hell are you looking after her? Why aren't you looking into somebody important like Schumann Heink? And I said, well, they don't compute, you know. And people knew a lot about Schumann Heink, but they didn't know about Ada Jones. I discovered her in my grandfather's collection of cylinders when I was teaching a unit in a junior high on the gay 90s. And I reviewed that the phonograph came out for home use in the 90s. And I remembered as a boy playing in my aunt's attic with this old cylinder player and some of the cylinders. My aunt was an antique collector's delight. She never threw anything away. If it was through using it, you put it in the attic. And my mother spent 2 days digging through that to find the cylinders when I wanted to use them for this class. And of all the cylinders in it, Ada's was the only woman's voice. And I thought, I wonder whatever became of her. And I started looking. So I set out digging around. I found out that newspaper men and librarians are the most helpful people in the world, closely followed by collectors, who have helped me immeasurably. I see one of the marvelous librarians here, Phil Miller, helped me very early in my career. It was good to see Harold Anderson yesterday, because 20 years ago, when I first came to the site, Harold was still there and patiently plod through a lot of things with me. And Leah is here this morning. She's done the same thing. As late as last October, I discovered another record of Ada Jones I didn't know she made through the cash books that Leah let me use. Got a hold of Jim Walsh after I found the Hobbies series, and he told me it was pretty much a closed issue, a dead end. Nobody knew exactly where she was born or when, that her husband had died in the 40s, that her daughter had died in the 30s. The people that he tried to find in Huntington Station no longer lived there. The newspaper where she died had lost the files. They didn't have an account of it. The New York Public Library told me, essentially, Jim Walsh has done everything there is to do in this direction, forget it. And to tell somebody who's half German something like that just made me all the more determined. After I discovered she was really historically important as the first woman who really made a reputation just through phonograph records. She truly was the first lady, as far as the definition goes, that she was the prominent woman in her art and profession. Women were not that successful at making records. A few were making commercial records before Ada Jones' main career started in 1905. Minnie Emmett for Columbia, Estella Mann for Zonophone, and especially Corrine Morgan for Edison. They had kind of cultured, trained voices, and that gave them problems of clarity on the records. And you remember in the vaudeville skits that the men were doing that they didn't have women play women's roles, but the men did them in falsetto, which always sounded exactly like men doing women's roles in falsetto. So when Ada came along, she had that kind of naive voice quality and a long background of experience in the theater and in song slide illustration. And when Billy Murray heard her at Huber's Museum, he said, maybe that girl would work. She is dubbed the first lady of the phonograph, not obviously because she was the first woman to record, because that was somebody in 1877 on the tinfoil machine, I'm sure. But she was, we found out later, the first woman to make solo commercial records for the North American Phonograph Company in late 1893, early 1894. But as you know, Edison declared bankruptcy shortly after that and didn't make records for a while. In the meantime, she went into her song slide illustration. I found out through a set of circumstances I'll tell you about later that Ada was born in Oldham, England on June 1st, 1873. And Teresa Simpson, the librarian in Oldham, trudged over to St. Patrick's Church and made a copy for me of her baptismal entry. This was made on the 15th of June, 73, and in Latin it tells that she was christened Ada Jane Jones, daughter of James and Anne Jane Walsh, and her godfather was Henry Quinn, godmother was Catherine Walsh of Manchester Street in Oldham. Trying to trace the birth of somebody in England named Jones was not exactly easy. And they told me that really the information I wanted was terribly recent because it was just in the 1870s, you know. So. But persistence paid off, and from London I got a little more information about Ada's birth. Her father was listed as innkeeper of the British flag, which was on Manchester Street. And this gave us definite proof that she was born on June 1st. They lived in Manchester, or in Oldham, for quite a while, 5 years, I think, since after this birth. Ada early evidenced mimicry ability. She would imitate whatever she heard, and her father took great delight in this as the bartender and stuck her up on the bar, and she entertained the customers at the British Flag. And sometime after 1875, when she was 2 or 3 years old, the family emigrated to Philadelphia. A little boy, James, was born there. He was 6 months old on June 1st, 1880. So they were obviously there in 79. Ada's mother had died and her father remarried Annie Jones, Annie Maloney Douglas Jones. And she was a stage mama, and she took great pride in using the little girl as an outlet for her own frustrated stage aspirations. And early in Philadelphia, you'll find a record of little Ada Jones appearing in theaters and on sheet music covers. This Arch Street address, incidentally, is the house next door to Betsy Ross' house, where the Philadelphia. This is a sheet music cover, an engraving. The cover is dated 1882, and the song is copyright 1883, so you can take your choice. 82-3 features little Ada Jones in all the principal theaters in America, which means east of the Mississippi at that time. She was 9 or 10 at this time. Sam Stark, the theater collector, sent me a program from 1886, when Ada was 12 or 13. Well, she was 13 by this time. And you can see here she's billed as Jack, a stable boy with song. And she's still billed as little Ada Jones. Early movie buffs will be interested to see that this J.H. Bunny was the famous John Bunny, the fat comedian of the silent films. You find a lot of these people who later became very famous associating with one another in their early years. This is a photograph of how she looked as Jack the stable boy. This is she without song. I have a picture of their daughter, Sheila, at about the same age, and you can barely tell them apart. Her career began to have to stop calling her little Ada Jones. Her role in this was Jack, and he was supposed to be a starving lad, and the line was, "How is my starving child?" And they lifted up Ada and got a laugh in the theater because it was quite an effort. This is a list of some of the other appearances she made between 1886 and 1893. These are in various places. Coster and Biles was in New York, and it was in Variety. And her act was to stand in a pretty dress and sing songs, although she wanted to be a comedian. She always had the bent to be a funny girl. But that was not what girls did in those days. You had to stand in nice ruffles and sing songs. She appeared in dramatic productions like Three Blind Mice and Running Wild and A Pair of Jacks, A Naughty Affair. She appeared with John Rice, Gladys's father, and Sally Cohen, Gladys's mother, as a child in vaudeville. And she did some touring, as you can see, to Toledo. In places like the Atlantic Garden, that was just a beer garden, where acts came on while they served another growler. But this took her between when she was little Ada Jones, the first couple of entries, to she just became Ada Jones in 1893 when she was 20 years old. They lived in Newark, New Jersey at that time, and her mother Annie was a good seamstress, and Harold Anderson helped me dig through some early financial records of the Edison North American Phonograph Company. And Annie Jones came up here to sew some drapes for the recording studio. And when she found out what was going on, she thought, Ada. So she brought Ada up in 1893, late 93, early 94. and recorded a couple of the numbers that she was doing in her song slide act. In Alan Konigsberg's listing of the Cylinder Records, these two 1200 series records listed from Brevoort Odell, who has the actual records. I'm hoping he'll will them to me. And I want to play the 1289 record for you of Sweet Marie. Now, there's a lot of surface noise, obviously, and there's a clunk, 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 but this is the earliest record I have of Ada Jones when she was 20 years old. I will also show you the sheet music so you can imagine your hearing. Even at this crude stage, she has diction that was clear, which was one of her trademarks in the recording industry.
Here is the record number 1289, sung by the Ada Jones.
The pianist on this record was Frank P. Banta, the elder Frank Banta, who died in 1904. Paul Sharash sent me this program from Proctor's Ladies Club Theater of 1895, which was 2 years later after the record you heard. And you notice her billing here is near the bottom, which was a star spot as a superb contralto singer of sweet ballads. Nobody ever knew what to call Ada. Some advertised her as a soprano, others as a contralto. She didn't have a very great range. She was probably kind of a mezzo. You notice one of the acts here is Press Eldridge, the famous minstrel performer who made some early cylinders for Edison. There's some interesting acts on here. Eccentric comedian, a versatile musician, juggling on a revolving globe. Ada was also very popular in her song slide illustration work at Bradenburg's in Philadelphia and at Young's Pier in Atlantic City. Here are some ads and reviews from the Atlantic City paper. This is in 1902. And here you see she's performing with Sally Stemler and the great Vitagraph. In this one, it says that they want to keep her for another series of weeks. And down here, they said they'd like to keep her even more than the 8 weeks. But she had to go on her other commitments. She was very popular as a song slide illustrator, and therefore they put her picture quite often on sheet music of the late 90s and early 1900s. This is what I call her Shirley Temple picture. This was on a sheet music of 1899 called Sing Me the Songs That Mother Sang. The ladies always liked this hat. This was a year later, 1900, on a song called Then. At about this time, 1900, she began working at Huber's Museum. And when Danton Walker somehow picked up that I was looking for Ada Jones, without being asked, put a little item in his column. And a dear lady wrote in and said, I remember working at Huber's Museum with Ada Jones in 1900. So I lost very little time getting a hold of Lucy Bell, who with her husband Dave Whiteley had a Dutch Waltz Clog act, and they appeared with Ada, and I jumped in the car and drove down to Yonkers and joined her in her apartment, and this is how she looked. She was in her 80s then, and I took along the tape recorder, and I'm going to let her tell you in her own words a little bit about working with Ada.
When I knew Ada, it was about 1900, I think. The first time I met her was working at Hubert's on the same show, you know. Now maybe we would be on ahead of her, or she'd be on ahead of us, you know. And I took a liking to Ada. She's a refined girl, you know, and a lot of them weren't so much in those days.
Rough
and ready, old variety actors, you know. But Ada was a different type. They had a screen with the pictures of the song shown on the picture on the screen.
And
a good size screen, and she stood at the side and sang.
And where was the piano?
Well, from the orchestra. That would be down
the
orchestra. Yeah, that was down in the orchestra pit.
Did she sing with an orchestra at
Huber's? No, a piano in, I don't think they had an orchestra in Huber's. And of course with the show, I think we only had a piano with the show, but she had a big screen. Oh, it was as big as that wall, if not bigger, see? And the pictures, they were still
slides,
pictures,
yeah.
You know. They would move as she sang, see? That was her regular act, the always illustrated songs, they called it, see? She did five shows a day, I think, at Hubert's. Five times a day we went on
what,
there.
What did you do when you were waiting to go on? Were you backstage?
Yeah, I was sitting in the dressing room.
Somebody
going
came
out to eat. We had time to go out to eat. See?
Somebody came give you a cue when it was time.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'd know. We could hear. The dressing rooms were right near the stage, you know. When we were with the Spawn show, after the show at night, I'd go to her room, and we'd open a can of beans and a can of shrimp, and we'd have a glass of beer after the show was over at night.
She was very fond of eating late at night.
Yes, well, we did. We'd always had, and crackers.
But
now,
you
just the two of us, just the two of us. And I remember one time, Ada got so mad, they sold lemonade, you know, with a Spawn show. And Huey come over and told us that his partner, Billy Fowle, was washing his hands in the lemonade. Oh, we thought that was terrible, you know, and then selling it to the people. But afterwards we found out it wasn't so, you know. Just told us that to upset us. Just a gag, that was all.
That was Huey. He was a typical, almost a stereotype, rollicking, fun-loving Irishman. The little noise in the background is that she would not talk to me unless I would leave the soap opera on in the background, because she didn't want to miss in case something happened she wanted to know about. She was also cooking some turnips, and when you heard me ask her to sit down, she was always standing like this, ready to go check the turnips. And I thought, I don't care, you know, I'll get it when I can. Lucy died a couple of years after this, and I was awfully glad I got to know her. This is Ada in her feather boa at about the time 1903, 1904, when Lucy Blatt knew her. Now, in another set of circumstances involve a librarian I'll tell you about a little bit later, I discovered, after searching and searching and searching for Huey Flaherty's obituaries and death certificates and never finding them, I discovered that he was still alive and well and living in Brooklyn. So I contacted him, and he said, no, he was not the man I was looking for. But just holding the paper in my hands, I got the vibes that he really was. And so my 50% German blood didn't give up until I convinced him that my desire to know more about Ada was legit, and I wasn't going to do anything that he didn't want me to do. So it didn't take me long to get to Brooklyn either. This is the document that made it possible for me to get Ada's birth certificate. This is the marriage certificate of Huey and Ada in 1904 in Manhattan. And it gives their parents' names, the place of birth, and their ages in 1904. So with that information, the people in London were willing to talk to me about finding her birth certificate. This is Huey when I knew him, and you can see he's still got his Irish wit. I asked him a few things about Ada that only a person living with her probably would know, and this is a conversation I had with Huey.
In so many places, Ada is described as blue-eyed.
And yeah, she's not. She wasn't blue-eyed. Dark eyes. I don't know whether they were brown. Buxom, she was blonde. She wasn't blue-eyed. She wasn't. Her hair was a mouse color. A brown, between a brown and a brunette. She was brunette. When she was going to on a job or anything, she had it dressed. But she liked her hair combed straight back.
My Carolina lady.
That was the number. That was the ballad of all ballads. That was the one of the best ballads I ever heard. My own, my queen, my little Carolina lady, soon our wedding bells will sweetly chime. You are my own, I'm yours, my Carolina lady, and I'm thinking of you all the time. I wake and call, but you don't hear me. Only then I seem to know you're far away, and then I see a vision of a cozy cottage room, sitting by the fireside, you and I. And I off. Right, I won't sing.
Finished. You can't leave in the middle.
Oh, I can. I used to walk off in the middle of a show. I don't know why I can't walk in the middle of this.
And he did. You just heard Mr. Hugh Flaherty sing My Carolina Lady. Now you'll hear Mrs. Hugh Flaherty sing My Carolina Lady. It was her first Edison issue on the wax cylinder.
My Carolina Lady, sung by Miss Ada Jones, Edison Records.
Little tricky photographic process there. All of these slides were hand colored because it was before the development of color photography, of course. This is Ada and Huey's daughter, Sheila, and her father gave me this picture. Her nickname was Skip. She didn't care much about showbiz. She didn't sing at all. She did take dancing lessons. Huey was a dancer. She was married twice, had a son from each marriage, and I have never been successful in locating either of them. Somewhere there must be a direct line, but I haven't found them yet. This is a made-up picture. They took two photographs and stuck them together, but it's one of the few pictures where you have Ada and Len together. As you know, her early association with recording was in the skits, at which Len was a genius of condensing things into a two-minute cylinder. And they took a popular song of the day and kind of set it off in a little setting. The first they issued for Edison was Heine, and they lampooned the so-called German accent. All of their accents were very broad, And those who listen to them today say, well, it doesn't sound Yiddish, it doesn't sound German, it doesn't really sound Irish. But at the time, it was just supposed to be a funny takeoff on them anyway. So here she is being German with Len.
Vaudeville specialty, a Heine, by Ada Jones and Len Spencer at a Sun Record.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Postman. Oh, it's a letter from my fella Heine Schneider. Oh, it's a Valentine. What a pretty smell. What is this? If you love you like I love me, so nice can put our love together. I'll be off tonight. Oh, that's just like Heine. I'm so happy I could sing. My Heine is a sailor, and he sails the sea across. He is captain of a whaler, fond of everything he is for. I know my Heine loves me, when he is far away. And I love Heine also, and to him I do say.
What do you say, Katrina?
Oh, Heine, you frighten me so, I'm afraid.
Afraid you will lose me, yes? No?
Yes.
Yes?
Oh, no, no. Heine, why you didn't answer my letter?
Where did you send it, huh?
Captain Heine Schneider, Atlantic Ocean.
Atlantic Ocean? I get that the next time I go in swimming. I bet you I know what was in the letter, like this, huh?
Heine, oh, Heine, I love for you. No one can cut our love half in two. Heine, oh, Heine, if you will be mighty, I promise to speak to you just like you. Heine, I'm Heine, long side of you. But I've a heart that is faithful true. Heine, oh, Heine, if you should decline me, I'll jump in the ocean and swim out to you.
We thank you, Gera.
Oh, Heine, don't speak. Oh, Heine.
Two-minute wax cylinders are my favorite. If I ever found a room of them, I'd die in it, probably. So, this is the only thing I have in Ada's own handwriting. And if Jim Walsh were here, I'd pick at him about, he said Len Spencer taught her to do all these things. Well, she had 20 years on him on it, so. On the other side of this postcard, which I got from a lady that I discovered in Huntington Station, who as a girl had lived in the Jones household, taking care of Sheila and the house. And she had some records that belonged to Ada and this postcard, which she very kindly gave me. On the front is a picture taken at Atlantic City, which Ada says, don't I look like a Dutch housewife? And the lady with her is Elizabeth Boone, who wrote some of the vaudeville skits that Edison issued. This is one of the few pictures that Ada appears in with Billy Murray. And of course you recognize the quartet. Behind Billy, on Ada's right, is John Beeling, the first tenor. And behind her shoulder on her left is Steve Porter, who sang baritone. And seated on her left is William Hooley, the bass. She sang in 1916 a side for Edison called You Can Tell That I'm Irish with this quartet minus one. John Beeling, the first tenor, did not sing it. She took the melody line above the second tenor herself, and it was never issued. So I would like to play that for you now, this unissued diamond disc. There is one more in the archive. This also shows her ability to become Irish.
I can sing Yankee Doodle as much as I please, but everyone seems to be wise. As to who I am, what I am, everyone sees so perfectly plain in me eyes. You can tell that me father and mother, they were either from Dublin or Cork. That me name is Mac something or other. There are hundreds like me in New York. By the wink of the rogue you can tell, all the while, by the style, by the smile, you can tell, by the wit of the talk you can tell, by the swing of the walk you can tell very well, though I'm trying to be swell, that I'm Irish.
You can tell by the touch of the brogue, you can tell by the wink of the rogue, you can tell all the while, by the style, by the smile, you can tell by the wit of the talk, you can tell by the swing of the walk, you can tell very well, though I'm trying to be swell, that I'm
on my airs just as much as I please, me beautiful jewels and claws. But I'm Irish, I'm Irish, yes, everyone sees the cute little turn of me nose. When I go to a high-toned reception, oh, I try to be fancy and fine, but there's really no chance for deception, for they know I'm a real Maggie Klein. You can tell by the touch of the brogue, you can tell by the wink of the rogue, you can tell all the while, by the style, by the smile, you can tell by the wit of the talk, you can tell by the swing of the walk, you can tell very well, though I'm trying to be swell, that I'm Irish.
You can tell by the touch of the brogue, you can tell by the wink of the rogue, you can tell all the while, by the style, by the smile, you can tell by the wink of the talk, you can tell by the swing of the walk, you can tell very well, though I'm trying to be swell, that I'm Irish.
Here's that composite picture with Ada and Billy this time. You can see he's a little larger than life. Of course, her first duet association after Len Spencer was with Billy, and I'm playing their last Victor record for you. And this was issued in January of 1922, the year she died. And this is, 29 years after the first record you heard of Sweet Marie.
Katie O'Connor, I just got the news that Hughes is engaged to be with.
You're such a joke, right? Believe me and say, I loved him before in his head.
But what makes you take such a chance?
Why, the way that my friends is content. When friends is dances with me, Holly G, I'm as proud as can be.
When it comes to dancing, that's sure what you love.
Why, I sit in his arms like a motorman's glove.
Oh, the Bowery, the Bowery. Does Hughes go down there anymore?
No, he wears a tuxedo, and boy, how it fits.
He must look like the head waiter up at the Ritz.
And I wear the gown that's got 28 splits. When friends and dances with me.
Say, Katie, I suppose that since you met this Francis guy, there ain't much chance for me.
Oh, I'm awful sorry, Billy, and I hope you ain't got no hard feelings, because I don't want you to feel bad. You know I'll always be a sister to you.
Gee, that ain't much consolation to a guy what's been figuring on a swell little bungalow out in the country with roses and everything.
Oh, I like you well enough, Billy. But you know, you ain't losing any sleep over me. What you want is some high-class goily. What's got a college education? You know, a beautiful goil with brains.
No, I don't, Katie. I just want you.
How do you get that way?
Well, I'm sure glad to know that you found such a mate. You're set for the rest of your life.
I'll say he's a wonder, and when he eats, they never rolls off of his knife.
He shows etiquette when he dines.
But a dance is that where Francis shines. When Francis dances with me, Holly G, I'm as gay as can be.
I'll bet when you're waltzing with heaven, you float.
He steps on my toes and it don't seem to hurt.
Oh, the Bowery, the Bowery.
We don't go down there anymore.
What makes his hair shine so?
He combs it with tact.
Don't forget the Palm Beach and the brown doily hat.
Now you know a guy can't look sweller than that.
When Francis dances with me.
That's one of the Bowery tough girls she used to play too. You name it, she'd try it. Thanks to Isabel Sayers, who's here this morning, I got to have an interview with Walter Van Brunt and corresponded with Walter. It was mostly one way because he hated to write back. Walter talking about she needed a partner. At this time, Billy Murray took one of the early exclusive contracts with Victor and Edison and could not sing for Columbia, so Ada was out of that partnership. And in those days, you know, they just put their arrangement under their arms and went from studio to studio. If they did one here at Edison, they'd call up and say, I just did this at Edison, and Columbia would say, well, come on over and do it for us, and then they'd go over to Victor. Ada never had an exclusive contract. As far as I know, she never used a nom de disque. She always sang under her own name. And Walter Van Brunt was 17 years old when he started recording with Ada. And Billy had heard him at a minstrel show, and Walter did an imitation of Billy's singing, and that's why Billy suggested him. He started with her on Indestructible Cylinders and then went to the discs. And this is what he told us about working with Ada.
Naturally, I was impressed because she was a big star and records and so forth. She had a mother type, yeah. You know what I mean? And she was old enough at that time. And she probably was anxious to please me because she wanted a partner. She probably did I didn't know it, but now that I look back, she probably went overboard to be nice to me. Lovely. We never had a word. All the time I worked with her, I can never recall when we ever even disagreed. And if we had a disagreement, it was a pleasant one. We could argue it out. You know, you'd say, well, don't you think, Ada, it would be better if it went this way? She said, well, let's try it. And if she thought, she'd say, yes, I guess that's a better way to do it, and vice versa. She said, I'm not comfortable, so do you think? Sure. My voice evidently cut a little more than Ada's, and I would stand back of her shoulder. I'd put my arm around her lots of times. And especially where I was singing harmony, I'd have to get back a little so that it wouldn't drown Ada's voice out. And when Ada would sing solo, she'd stand in. And when I hired a solo part, Ada would move over, you see. We'd do that. And then, on the interludes, in between verses, we'd both duck down so there's the sound of the orchestra. Then we'd have to come up, you see. It was a dot, there's a lot of this business, you ever saw. If you had a headache, well, it wasn't so good.
When you were both singing.
Then I'd put my arm around and almost had our heads together. Ah, yeah, she was a grand little girl.
Ship ahoy! Oh, joy, what a feeling!
Well, boys!
In the ceiling, ho, high, hoopla, we fly to the sky so high. Come, Josephine, in my flying machine, going up she goes.
Up she goes.
Balance herself like a bird on a beam in the air, she goes.
Well, she goes.
Up, a little bit higher.
Oh, my, the moon is on fire.
Come, Josephine, in my flying machine, going up.
All on, goodbye.
This is a picture showing Ada and Cal Stewart, the Uncle Josh, and it kind of is a good picture to show how if the person was shorter, he had to stand on a box to bring the head up to the same level as the other person. And that is about the size of the recording horn, and the material they're doing is held by Cal. This is about 1919 when they redid the Uncle Josh, Aunt Nancy skits. I'm playing the famous Put Up the Kitchen Stove, right?
My days are gliding swiftly by, and I, a pilgrim stranger.
Nancy, you don't know where I put my fish line, do you?
No, I don't. Would not detain them as they fly.
You didn't take it to tie up something, did you?
No, I didn't. Those hours of toil and danger.
I wonder what become of it.
I don't know and I don't care. For we stand on Jordan's strand.
I put it away here somewhere.
Well, wherever you put it, that's where it is. Our friends are passing over.
I wish you'd stop singing for a while and help me find that fish line.
I wish you'd stop fishing for a while and put up the kitchen stove. And just before...
You can do all the cooking you know how to do on the fireplace.
I cooked for 3 different men before I married you. The Shining Shore.
Yes, and they're all dead now.
I know another one that's dead, only he's too stingy to have a funeral. We may almost discover.
Well, if I had someone to help me, I'd put up the darned old stove.
I'll help you, but you needn't swear about it.
Well, come on, where's the stovepipe?
It's all there in the kitchen.
Well, now, when I lift the stove, you put the leg in. Well, how long do you want me to hold it? Put the leg in.
Well, wait till I see which way it goes.
Oh, thunderation, you must think I'm a derrick. Now, try it again.
Well, don't wobble the stove so. There, that one's in.
Then I'll see if you can do the other ones that way. Put the leg in the stove. Don't you see me lifting?
They're all in now.
Well, now get me the stepladder and I'll put the pipe up.
Here it is. Now be careful.
Now hand me the pipe. Not that piece, the one with the elbow on it. Now hand me the screwdriver.
You've got it in your pocket.
Hold the ladder. Hold this piece of pipe.
I can't. I'm holding the ladder.
Hold the ladder with one hand and the pipe with the other. Now hand me the hammer.
Look out, the ladder's slipping.
Gosh, a lot of help you are. Why didn't you hold the ladder?
I didn't have enough hands.
Well, now quit crying. I'll fix it. Just wait till I get to the telephone. Hello, give me Pumpkin Center J4 Ring 5. Hello, this Ezra Hoskins store. That's you, Ezra? Say, Ezra, if you see Jim Lawson around there, tell him to come over and put up a kitchen stove for me. And say, Ezra, send me a fish line by Jim. I'm going fishing.
This is a publicity shot in 1919, about the same time she made that record. She was not mechanically inclined. She was not even handy in the kitchen. She was an artiste. She did not play the piano either. She did not read music, actually. She learned everything by ear rather quickly and rather well. She had to, this is kind of prophetic, she had to take to the road right after World War I because the styles in music changed, styles in performance changed, and the A&R men were calling on her less and less to do new recordings. So she went on a personal appearance tour to the smaller communities where people really knew and loved her from her records. And it was a hard way to make a living, but she told the lady that lived with her, she says, I'm going to make that $1 million yet. And when you got paid $20 or $30 for a recording session with no royalties involved, it took a lot of singing to do that. This is a program Jim Walsh sent me from Marion, Virginia in 1922 when she was appearing on her tour. This was titled Ada Jones Sending a Joke by Wireless. Some people think that that really is an early Crystal set. If any of you are authorities, it was on one of these tours in Rocky Mount, North Carolina that she died. And that is part of the Ada Jones Memorial Collection of this and that. I have also for you the discography, the cylindography, and the addenda. Every time you put anything down on paper, somebody comes up with something new, fortunately. And I'd be very happy for you to take those. Those are all the records I know of after 20 years that she's on. I'm sure there's probably about that many more someplace. And if you find old catalogs and old records, I'd like to hear from you. Thank you very much for coming this morning.
From March 1977, Milford Fargo's presentation of Ada Jones, First Lady of the Phonograph. This program can also be had on compact disc by simply going to www.americansoundarchive.com. Click on our recordings button, which will take you to our online catalog, and you will find it listed as issue ASA 5003. If you have any comments, future program ideas, or a request for a song that you would like to hear on future podcasts of Notable Notes, please drop us a line by email at asacurator@aol.com. That is spelled asacurator. Once again, that address is asacurator@aol.com. Well, that's our program for this month, and we hope you enjoyed it. Next month, Santa will be on his way with a stocking full of classic Christmas carols, hymns, and stories, all from the archives and vaults of the Edison Recording Company. Holiday greetings from the Bunch at Orange, the subject of our next podcast here on Notable Notes. Notable Notes is a monthly podcast brought to you by Document Records in association with American Sound Archives. I'm your host, Larry Tedder, thanking you once again for joining us, and hope you'll be here next month for our special holiday edition of Notable Notes.